Chapter 62. The applause which the performance of Hugh and his new friend elicited from the company at the booth had not yet subsided, and the two dancers were still panting from their exertions, which had been of a rather extreme and violent character, when the party was reinforced by the arrival of some more guests, who, being a detachment of United Bulldogs, were received with very flattering marks of distinction and respect. The leader of this small party, for, including himself, they were but three in number, was our old acquaintance, Mr. Tappertit, who seemed, physically speaking, to have grown smaller with years, particularly as to his legs, which were stupendously little, but who, in a moral point of view, in personal dignity and self-esteem, had swelled into a giant. Nor was it by any means difficult for the most unobservant person to detect this state of feeling in the quondam apprentice, for it not only proclaimed itself impressively and beyond mistake in his majestic walk and kindling eye, but found a striking means of revelation in his turned-up nose, which scouted all things of earth with deep disdain, and sought communion with its kindred skies. Mr. Tappertit, as chief or captain of the Bulldogs, was attended by his two lieutenants, one, the tall comrade of his younger life, the other, a prentice knight in days of yore, Mark Gilbert, bound in the olden time to Thomas Curzon of the Golden Fleece. These gentlemen, like himself, were now emancipated from their prentice thraldom, and served as journeymen. But they were, in humble emulation of his great example, bold and daring spirits, and aspired to a distinguished state in great political events. Hence their connection with the Protestant Association of England, sanctioned by the name of Lord George Gordon, and hence their present visit to the booth. Gentlemen, " said Mr. Tappertit, taking off his hat as a great general might in addressing his troops. "Well met. My lord does me, and you the honor, to send his compliments herself. You've seen my lord too, have you?" said Dennis. "I see him this afternoon. My duty called me to the lobby when our shop shut up, and I saw him there, sir," Mr. Tappertit replied, as he and his lieutenants took their seats. "How do you do?" "Lively, master, lively," said the fellow. "Here's a new brother, regularly put down in black and white by Muster Gashford. A credit to the cause, one of the stick-at-nothing sort, one arter my own heart. D'ye see him? Has he got the looks of a man that'll do you think?" he cried, as he slapped Hugh on the back. "Looks or no looks," said Hugh, with a drunken flourish of his arm, "I'm the man you want. I hate the papists, every one of 'em. They hate me, and I hate them. They do me all the harm they can, and I'll do them all the harm I can. Hurrah!" "Was there ever," said Dennis, looking round the room, when the echo of his boisterous voice bad died away, "was there ever such a game boy? Why, I mean to say, brothers, that if Muster Gashford had gone 100 mile, and got together 50 men of the common run, they wouldn't have been worth this one." The greater part of the company implicitly subscribed to this opinion, and testified their faith in Hugh by nods and looks of great significance. Mr. Tappertit sat and contemplated him for a long time in silence, as if he suspended his judgment, then drew a little nearer to him, and eyed him over more carefully, then went close up to him, and took him apart into a dark corner. "I say," he began, with a thoughtful brow, "haven't I seen you before?" "It's like you may," said Hugh, in his careless way. "I don't know, shouldn't wonder." "No, but it's very easily settled," returned Sim. "Look at me. Did you ever see me before? You wouldn't be likely to forget it, you know, if you ever did. Look at me. Don't be afraid. I won't do you any harm. Take a good look steady now. apostrophe, the encouraging way in which Mr. Tappertit made this request, and coupled it with an assurance that he needn't be frightened, amused Hugh mightily, so much indeed, that he saw nothing at all of the small man before him, through closing his eyes in a fit of hearty laughter, which shook his great broadsides until they ached again. Come. Apostrophe, apostrophe, said Mr. Tappertit, growing a little impatient under this disrespectful treatment. Do you know me, feller? Apostrophe, not I, apostrophe, cried Hugh. Ha ha ha! Not I. But I should like to. Apostrophe, and yet I'd have wagered a 7-shilling piece, said Mr. Tappertit, folding his arms, and confronting him with his legs wide apart, and firmly planted on the ground, that he once were hostler at the Maypole. Apostrophe, Hugh opened his eyes on hearing this, and looked at him in great surprise. Apostrophe, and so you were too, apostrophe, said Mr. Tappertit, pushing him away with a condescending playfulness. When did my eyes ever deceive, unless it was a young woman? Don't you know me now? Apostrophe, why it and apostrophe, you faltered. And it? Apostrophe, apostrophe, said Mr. Tappertit. Are you sure of that? You remember G. Varden, don't you? Apostrophe, certainly you did, and he remembered D. Varden too, but that he didn't tell him. You remember coming down there, before I was out of my time, to ask after a vagabond that had bolted off, and left his disconsolate father a prey to the bitterest emotions, and all the rest of it, don't you? Apostrophe, apostrophe, said Mr. Tappertit. Of course I do. Apostrophe, apostrophe, cried Hugh. And I saw you there. Apostrophe, saw me there. Apostrophe, apostrophe, said Mr. Tappertit. Yes, I should think you did see me there. The place would be troubled to go on without me. Don't you remember my thinking you liked the vagabond, and on that account going to quarrel with you, and then finding you detested him worse than poison, going to drink with you? Don't you remember that? Apostrophe, apostrophe, to be sure. Apostrophe, apostrophe, cried Hugh. Well, and are you in the same mind now? Apostrophe, said Mr. Tappertit. Yes. Apostrophe, apostrophe, roared Hugh. You speak like a man, apostrophe, said Mr. Tappertit, and I'll shake hands with you. Apostrophe, with these conciliatory expressions he suited the action to the word, and Hugh meeting his advances readily, they performed the ceremony with a show of great heartiness. I find, apostrophe, said Mr. Tappertit, looking round on the assembled guests, that brother what's his name, and I are old acquaintance. You never heard anything more of that rascal, I suppose, eh? Apostrophe, apostrophe, not a syllable, apostrophe, replied Hugh. I never want to. I don't believe I ever shall. He's dead long ago, I hope. Apostrophe, it's to be hoped, for the sake of mankind in general and the happiness of society, that he is, apostrophe, said Mr. Tappertit, rubbing his palm upon his legs, and looking at it between whiles. Is your other hand at all cleaner? Much the same. Well, I'll owe you another shake. We'll suppose it done, if you've no objection. Apostrophe, Hugh laughed again, and with such thorough abandonment to his mad humor, that his limbs seemed dislocated, and his whole frame in danger of tumbling to pieces. But Mr. Tappertit, so far from receiving this extreme merriment with any irritation, was pleased to regard it with the utmost favor, and even to join in it, so far as one of his gravity and station could, with any regard to that decency and decorum which men in high places are expected to maintain. Mr. Tappertit did not stop here, as many public characters might have done, but calling up his brace of lieutenants, introduced Hugh to them with high commendation, declaring him to be a man who, at such times as those in which they lived, could not be too much cherished. Further, he did him the honor to remark that he would be an acquisition, of which even the United Bulldogs might be proud, and finding, upon sounding him, that he was quite ready and willing to enter the society, for he was not at all particular, and would have leagued himself that night with anything, or anybody, for any purpose whatsoever, caused the necessary preliminaries to be gone into upon the spot. This tribute to his great merit delighted no man more than Mr. Dennis, as he himself proclaimed with several rare and surprising oaths, and indeed it gave unmingled satisfaction to the whole assembly. "Make anything you like of me!" apostrophe apostrophe cried Hugh, flourishing the can he had emptied more than once. "Put me on any duty you please. I'm your man. I'll do it. Here's my captain, here's my leader. Ha ha ha! Let him give me the word of command, and I'll fight the whole Parliament House single-handed, or set a lighted torch to the King's throne itself." Apostrophe apostrophe with that, he smote Mr. Tappertit on the back, with such violence, that his little body seemed to shrink into a mere nothing, and roared again until the very foundlings near at hand were startled in their beds. In fact, a sense of something whimsical in their companionship seemed to have taken entire possession of his rude brain. The bare fact of being patronized by a great man whom he could have crushed with one hand, appeared in his eyes so eccentric and humorous, that a kind of ferocious merriment gained the mastery over him, and quite subdued his brutal nature. He roared and roared again, toasted Mr. Tappertit 100 times, declared himself a bulldog to the core, and vowed to be faithful to him to the last drop of blood in his veins. All these compliments Mr. Tappertit received as matters of course flattering enough in their way, but entirely attributable to his vast superiority. His dignified self-possession only delighted Hugh the more, and in a word, this giant and dwarf struck up a friendship which bade fair to be of long continuance, as the one held it to be his right to command, and the other considered it an exquisite pleasantry to obey. Nor was Hugh by any means a passive follower, who scrupled to act without precise and definite orders, for when Mr. Tappertit mounted on an empty cask which stood by way of rostrum in the room, and volunteered a speech upon the alarming crisis then at hand, he placed himself beside the orator, and though he grinned from ear to ear at every word he said, threw out such expressive hints to scoffers, in the management of his cudgel, that those who were at first the most disposed to interrupt, became remarkably attentive, and were the loudest in their approbation. It was not all noise and jest, however, at the booth, nor were the whole party listeners to the speech. There were some men at the other end of the room, which was a long, low-roofed chamber, in earnest conversation all the time, and when any of this group went out, fresh people were sure to come in soon afterwards, and sit down in their places, as though the others had relieved them on some watch or duty, which it was pretty clear they did, for these changes took place by the clock, at intervals of half an hour. These persons whispered very much among themselves, and kept aloof, and often looked round, as jealous of their speech being overheard. Some two or three among them entered in books, what seemed to be reports from the others. When they were not thus employed, one of them would turn to the newspapers which were strewn upon the table, and from the Street James Chronicle, the Herald, Chronicle, or Public Advertiser, would read to the rest in a low voice some passage having reference to the topic in which they were all so deeply interested. But the great attraction was a pamphlet called The Thunderer, which espoused their own opinions, and was supposed at that time to emanate directly from the association. This was always in request, and whether read aloud, to an eager knot of listeners, or by some solitary man, was certain to be followed by stormy talking and excited looks. In the midst of all his merriment, and admiration of his captain, Hugh was made sensible by these and other tokens, of the presence of an air of mystery, akin to that which had, so much impressed him out of doors. It was impossible to discard a sense that something serious was going on, and that under the noisy revel of the public house, there lurked unseen and dangerous matter. little affected by this, however, he was perfectly satisfied with his quarters, and would have remained there till morning, but that his conductor rose soon after midnight to go home. Mr. Tappertit, following his example, left him no excuse to stay. So they all three left the house together, roaring a no popery song until the fields resounded with the dismal noise. "Cheer up, Captain!" cried Hugh, when they had roared themselves out of breath. "Another stave!" Mr. Tappertit, nothing loath, began again, and so the three went staggering on, arm in arm, shouting like madmen, and defying the watch with great valor. Indeed, this did not require any unusual bravery or boldness, as the watchman of that time, being selected for the office on account of excessive age and extraordinary infirmity, had a custom of shutting themselves up tight in their boxes on the first symptoms of disturbance, and remaining there until they disappeared. In these proceedings, Mr. Dennis, who had a gruff voice and lungs of considerable power, distinguished himself very much, and acquired great credit with his two companions. "What a queer fellow you are!" said Mr. Tappertit. "You're so precious sly and close. Why don't you ever tell what trade you're of?" "Answer the captain instantly!" cried Hugh, beating his hat down on his head. "Why don't you ever tell what trade you're of?" "I'm of as genteel a calling, brother, as any man in England, as light a business as any gentleman could desire." "Was you apprenticed to it?" asked Mr. Tappertit. "No. Natural genius," said Mr. Dennis. "No prenticing. It come by natter. Muster Gashford knows my calling. Look at that hand of mine, many and many a job that hand has done, with a neatness and dexterity never known afore. When I look at that hand," said Mr. Dennis, shaking it in the air, "and remember the elegant bits of work it has turned off, I feel quite melancholy to think it should ever grow old and feeble. But such is life." He heaved a deep sigh as he indulged in these reflections, and putting his fingers with an absent air on Hugh's throat, and particularly under his left ear, as if he were studying the anatomical development of that part of his frame, shook his head in a despondent manner and actually shed tears. "You're a kind of artist, I suppose, eh?" said Mr. Tappertit. "Yes," rejoined Dennis. "Yes, I may call myself a artist, a fancy workman, art improves matter, that's my motto." "And what do you call this?" said Mr. Tappertit, taking his stick out of his hand. "That's my portrait atop," Dennis replied. "Do you think it's like?" "Why, it's a little too handsome," said Mr. Tappertit. "Who did it? You?" "I. Repeated Dennis, gazing fondly on his image. "I wish I had the talent. That was carved by a friend of mine, as is now known. Gutenberg edition." End of chapter.